Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Get set for another amazing artistic odyssey because today on the show, we cover the gamut from a survey of the humanities with North Carolina Congressional Representative David Price to surveying the 21st century music scene with Forecast Music's Eric Schwartz. We'll dance with Hansel and Gretel, visit the filmmaker studio with Dale Pollack, tickle the ivories with Frédéric Chopin, and much more next on Triad Arts Weekend. University of North Carolina School of the Arts professor of cinema studies and producing, Mr. Dale Pollack is a true triad treasure. Dale's films have been nominated for 4 Academy Awards. He's worked with the veritable who's who of star actors, and he gives the new season of National Theatre of London Live in HD at Hanesbrands Theatre in Winston-Salem a hearty thumbs up. On Friday, January 18th at 8 o'clock, Academy Award nominee and Tony Award winner John Lithgow takes the title role in Arthur Wing Pinero's hilarious Victorian farce, The Magistrate. The performance is in London, but you can see and hear it live in HD right here in the Triad. You'll find links to the complete calendar at wfdd.org/triadarts. In the meantime, Dale recently stopped by to share his thoughts on the biz. Are you doing cinema studies this semester?
I am doing cinema studies. I'm teaching a class in film noir called New Perspectives on Film Noir, which I find is a genre that our students really relate to and identify with, both aesthetically and sort of culturally. So that's been really interesting. And I teach a 3-year series of the history of animation classes for our new animation students in the film school. We now have a full animation program that does both hand-drawn, digital, and puppet animation. So this term I'm teaching the history of experimental and stop-motion animation.
Wow, that sounds like fun.
Well, it is. And you know, for students who are really gearing to go into the commercial film business, being able to see these non-commercial films, abstract, experimental, really wild stuff that starts in the 1920s and goes right up until now, there are still a lot of artists working in this medium, I think has really been educational for them and showed them that there is another path other than simply going to work for Pixar or Disney, that you can do work on your own. A lot of what we've been looking at are what we call direct animation, where animators work directly on the film stock. So they're scratching, painting on raw film stock. They're painting the soundtrack by putting paint where the optical track goes. You create electronic sound. A lot of this was pioneered by a great Canadian animator named Norman McLaren, who just died in the 1980s, but had an amazing influence on animators all over the world in terms of this style of direct animation.
Wow, just no limits in terms of the creativity when you're talking about animation like that. Can you give me some perspective on the time commitment in terms of hours in some of those early animated films, going back to Disney's early stuff when they had teams of animators there just doing the physical drawings?
Well, you know, it usually takes an animation crew 2 to 3 years to do a feature film, even in our era of computer-designed imagery. It's a very time-consuming process because you have to build the characters and absolutely not only every movement they make, but everything that affects them. So the hair in the wind, the clothing. These are all real challenges for computer animation. They're actually easier in hand-drawn animation, but of course they took even longer in hand-drawn animation.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've produced 13 feature films,
right,
as some of our listeners may not know, working with some of the biggest stars in the business, talking about Paul Newman, Shirley MacLaine, Denzel Washington, Queen Latifah, Tommy Lee Jones, Kathleen Turner. What's the best part of that world, Dale, and what keeps you up at night?
Well, the best part of the world is when you see a director yells action. And an actor who may have not been in a great mood before then and maybe not the nicest person to the crew all of a sudden transforms and gives you a performance that you can't believe. And they yell cut, and they're back to who they were. And you know, you don't see this in stage acting where you have to build a performance over an entire evening and you're getting feedback from the audience all the time as you're building that performance. Film actors have to be on the money whenever the director says action. They have to pull up emotions from different parts of the story, different times when the scenes are actually filmed. So you may have an actor doing a very emotional scene about the death of a child. The death of the child hasn't been filmed yet, but that actor still has to summon up the emotion. So when I could see Paul Newman or Kathy Bates or Tommy Lee Jones or Shirley MacLaine just be right on their mark and right where they needed to be emotionally, it was always an amazing and transformative thing to witness.
And the nightmarish part of that is the first part you were alluding to.
Yes. Sometimes they're not in the best moods. They're not the easiest people to work with. They're a little demanding. They're a little neurotic. But when the cameras roll, all that goes away and the true performer steps up, and it's really something to see.
Along this long list of accomplishments in the biz and out of the biz includes film critic work, chief film critic and box office analyst for Daily Variety, going way back. But what are some key elements that have to be there for you, or are there?
Well, there are. Story is the first one. If you don't have a good, engaging story that pulls the audience in, doesn't matter how good your acting or your cinematography or your design or the special effects are, it's not going to work for an audience. So story is the most important thing. Is there a structure to it? Do we see it evolve and grow? And does it change the characters who are involved? That's what I look for above all. And then I look for a lot at the look of the movie, not just the camera work, but the design, the costumes, the hair and makeup. Is that a world that we believe in? You know, movies require this willing suspension of disbelief. And if the design of the film, the look of it, doesn't communicate that, once again, it doesn't matter how good the story is, we won't believe it. We won't buy into it. So it's those elements of buy-in I'm really looking for when I evaluate a movie. And sometimes films really defy easy analysis. I just saw The Master the other night, the new Paul Thomas Anderson film with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix. It has a very unusual story structure. The central conflict in the film is never really resolved, which is highly unusual. Yet the film has a tremendous power to it through both the look of it, the performances, and what the story is about. But it's not conventional in how it addresses those issues. So that kind of film, even though it doesn't fit all my criteria for what a good movie is, can still be a powerful and affecting film.
Internationally known film producer, reporter, critic, University of North Carolina School of the Arts professor, and author Dale Pollack. Dale's the author of Skywalking, The Life and Films of George Lucas. He's produced 13 feature films, and he gives the new season of National Theater of London live in HD at Hanesbrands Theater in Winston-Salem a hearty thumbs up. On Friday, January 18th at 8 o'clock, Academy Award nominee and Tony Award winner John Lithgow takes the title role in Arthur Wing Pinero's hilarious Victorian farce, The Magistrate. You'll find links to the complete season at wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford, and this is Triad Arts Weekend. We believe that members of the human race become more constructively human and aid the development of a more just and exciting society through thinking about, really thinking about, the human experience. So wrote the late Dr. John Caldwell, former chancellor of North Carolina State University and a founding member of the North Carolina Humanities Council. In that letter to the council written not long before his death in 1995, Caldwell was reflecting on the role of the humanities in the lives of North Carolinians. He dedicated much of his life to enriching the intellectual experience of all people, and his legacy lives on in literally thousands of individuals throughout our state and around the world who continue to be inspired by his teaching. The John Tyler Caldwell Award is the highest honor given by the North Carolina Humanities Council. Past recipients include Fred Chappell, Emily Herring Wilson, and John Hope Franklin. In October of 2011, scholar, statesman, and North Carolina congressional representative David Price accepted the John Tyler Caldwell Award for the Humanities at the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University. Prior to Representative Price receiving the award, Duke University President Richard Broadhead delivered the annual Caldwell Lecture in the Humanities. Singer-songwriter Laurel Lynn Dossett performed at the ceremony. Representative Price and President Broadhead spoke with me from Durham, North Carolina. Richard began by tackling that age-old question, what is it to be human?
To me, the whole heart of this is that humans have a power that, as far as we know, no other species have. Humans express themselves. They utter their thoughts, their feelings. They draw pictures. They dance. They build things. They take objects and turn them into sculptures or houses or any of a million things. And then those things that humans have made survive. All humans die, but the things humans make survive. And so a funny thing about human experience is we're always borrowing from the experience of others. We'll walk down the street and what will you see? Everybody has earphones in because they're listening to music, or every kid nowadays is sitting in front of a film. And so just something that was imagined by someone else or expressed by someone else enters your life and gives you a sense of greater fullness. I think, you know, we don't know ourselves by sitting inside ourselves. We know ourselves by exposing ourselves to the experience and wisdom of others, borrowing what's valuable from it, learning why we like something else better when we don't like what we see or what we hear.
I appreciate that perspective. I wish I had been in attendance to hear the pre-award granting lecture that you gave President Broadhead, but I will turn now to Representative Price to get your thoughts on that lecture and what stood out in your mind from that, what I understand was a very remarkable presentation prior to your receiving that John Tyler Caldwell Award.
Well, the first thing I should say is how grateful I am for the recognition by the North Carolina Humanities Council. I knew President Caldwell quite well and consider myself one who benefited from his counsel, his wisdom, his encouragement in my early years in politics.
What was an example of something that he said in terms of counsel or encouragement that stuck with you all these years?
Well, I tell you, when he reached out to me, when it really meant the most, was when I actually lost an election in 1994. That was a pretty difficult experience, and President Caldwell and I had talked throughout that period, and after that had happened, he was a member of a very prestigious group in Raleigh that met from time to time to discuss public affairs, and he made it a point to invite me to speak to that group in an informal way, in just a wonderful discussion after that difficult personal experience. I took that to be a real gesture of support and friendship, and it not only gave me a forum at that time, but more than that, it was a show of personal concern, I suppose, but also personal encouragement that helped me to articulate my thoughts and also determine that I would indeed attempt a political comeback, which did happen 2 years later.
So in terms of the timing of that, it sounds like that was a really remarkable thing, giving you that bolst of confidence at that right at that moment.
Quite a remarkable thing. It's really on the par with a call I got from President Broadhead's predecessor the day after the election, inviting me to resume my teaching post at Duke. I will never forget that. You can imagine how that felt after this personal setback to be told I was I had been on leave without pay at Duke for years, probably set a world record in that
and
regard.
Hoping to be on leave for more years.
And there I was. And so President Cahan called me and said, indeed, they wanted me back in the classroom as soon as I could get there. And that was right up there, too, with gestures of personal encouragement and support that I'll never forget. Mm.
President Broadhead, in terms of humanistic research, in terms of humanities in general, and your work at the Commission on Humanities and Social Scientists, looking back several years ago, I read an interesting article on, the importance of arts and humanities in sustaining a vibrant society. And it just happened to have been written by a then First Lady Hillary Clinton. It was in the Times many, many years back. I was struck by that, and I'm wondering if you would just take a moment to, to make the case for the importance of that study, and then we can get into the academic aspect.
Sure.
I want to see what's going on the ground these days.
Well, sure. In the modern world, we've tried to understand lots of subjects by isolating them from one another and specializing on them. And so we have people who used to take lots of different courses, who have pursued molecular biology for some length of time or computer science or something of that sort. But in the world, the full world that gives us all the greatest benefit, all the different dimensions of human life are always being brought together and held together in people's minds. I'm just reading the Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs. And of course, what's so interesting about it is his success was not just in technology and making technological gadgets, but in combining the world of technology, the world of music, the world of video, the world of design, putting all those pieces together. And for me, that's a kind of image nowadays, as I say, of the way we need to sort of put the different dimensions that we have temporarily separated so they go back together. Think about healthcare nowadays. Healthcare is a problem for medical researchers to help us with, but you also need economists, you need people who can work on the financial dimensions of it. But you and I both know there are many situations where people won't accept a cure that has been medically shown to be valid or valuable for reasons that have to do with their personal sense of values, cultural differences, things of that sort. So to understand any of the complicated issues we live with, you need the benefits of the arts and sciences brought together just in the fullest possible way.
Is that message resonating among students? And we'll use Duke as an example. Coincidentally, my father runs the head and neck surgery department at University of Wisconsin. Typically, they recruit two or three residents a year out of hundreds of applicants. Sure. Many, many times he selects applicants who just happen to be expert violinists or pianists, or who just happen to speak several languages or have interests that would revolve around humanistic study. What's going on the ground today in terms of making that case for the student at Duke who, like many, it would just assume go right into business school?
Well, first of all, let me say your dad has excellent taste. And, in general, the person who's most interesting and most creative over any period of their life is somebody who can do and wants to do more than one thing with their mind, who can bring all the different human powers together and put them in play. What I find with students is, go back to the earliest age, colleges make students choose a major, but you'll remember for most students coming to college, that's quite an alien concept. There's nothing really innate in the human mind that makes us want to study one subject at length and to the exclusion of other subjects. I think the natural form of curiosity is to pull things together. You open your mind to one thing, you open it to another thing, and then all of a sudden there's a spark as you realize those two things can be brought together. Again, for me, in the Steve Jobs example, that's just where it would arise. If he hadn't been an enthusiast for the music of his time, you wouldn't have the technological inventions that are his distinctive mark.
Let me chime in about Duke in particular, because I know quite well the history of the founding of what's now the Sanford School of Public Policy.
That's right.
And the idea that you expressed, that you don't want to train people too narrowly or too technically. You want someone coming through a public policy program, and for that matter, any program, to have a broad sense of history and to have wrestled with questions of ethics and values. And Joel Fleischman, the founding director of the Sanford School, and many of us who were part of that very young faculty that put the program together, I think had a real sense that we wanted a humanistic dimension to this program. One of the first people we hired was a historian. We, from the very beginning, had an ethics course. That was my job, to put together graduate ethics offering. So it is a liberal arts major, as well as training for some very specific and demanding jobs in the public and private sector. That has characterized Duke's public policy program from the beginning, and it's one of the things that attracted me to it and made me think this was a really sound way to educate young people going into public service.
I think you see it another way. We live at a time when people are moving. They're always moving in this country. But there are parts of the country that gain population and there are parts that lose population. The places that have been the magnets for people are places not just where there are good jobs. You also have to have good schools. You also have to have good health care. But typically, the cities and the suburban areas that have been magnets are places that also are culturally rich, culturally alive, places where there's clubs, where there's music, where there's community events that are often based in the arts. And to me, that's just another symbol of the way that it's the interaction of all these separate things together that really make for a rich life and the life that people seek.
Hush now, don't you wake up. We'll be.
You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And when we come back from this short break, we'll hear the second half of my conversation with Duke University President Richard Broadhead and the 2011 recipient of the John Tyler Caldwell Award for the Humanities, North Carolina Congressional Representative David Price. Then it's Karoff at the keyboard, and he's just Chopin at the bit. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Hello and welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And before the break, I was talking with the 2011 John Tyler Caldwell Award for the Humanities recipient, North Carolina Congressional Representative David Price. He currently serves on the House Appropriations Committee, but before he began serving in Congress in 1987, he was professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. He's the author of four books on Congress and the American political system. Also with me today is Duke President Richard Broadhead. He co-chairs the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on the Humanities and Social Sciences. It's a commission that his friend David Price helped to establish. For both men, education is vitally important. We'll rejoin our conversation now. Representative Price began with the hearty defense of our investment in public education.
I suppose living in the Research Triangle area of North Carolina, where for 50 years now, investing in public education, investing in research, improving our institutions, community colleges, historically black institutions, the research universities that have been such a part of the picture here, the economic picture as well as the cultural and social life. One would hope you wouldn't have to be too defensive about making the case for investments in public education and in well-rounded curricula in education at all levels. But I'm afraid we do have to make that case. I'm afraid educators and researchers cannot assume that their good works speak for themselves. We have to, I think, demonstrate over and over again the impact of education and research on our common life and why these are investments that society as a whole ought to make. That doesn't mean it's a blank checkbook. It doesn't mean we don't exercise judgment, set priorities, scrutinize, exercise oversight. Of course, those things need to be done, especially in tough economic times. But times like these are the last time that we ought to be thinking about cutting back in the key investments we make, which bear rich economic dividends in the future. We all know that, or we should know that, but also have much to do with the quality of our civic discourse and of our life together. We, in my Caldwell acceptance speech, I indicated some lessons from my years of reading and thinking about American political thought that I think shed light on our current situation, some of the anti-governmental attitudes and where those come from, a kind of deficient sense often of community and interdependence that we need to think about very hard in this society, and our inclination sometimes to absolutize our own political causes and values and to not bring to politics the kind of tolerance, the kind of humility, the willingness to listen that behooves us. All of these are lessons from the humanities and from the humanistic side, in my case, of political science, political philosophy. So there are so many lessons to be learned that we get only from our literary and historical and philosophical traditions. And sometimes, of course, those are very profound and very deeply mined by scholars. Other times, the general students in the classroom pick up ways of looking at the world that derive ultimately from these sources. So it's extremely important to cultivate them. And when we talk about investing in education and research, I think we have to be thinking about not just the science and math and engineering that we all know that is a matter of international competition, but also the broader strengths of American education, which, truth to tell, a lot of those Chinese and Japanese and other competitors look with some envy on the way Americans are trained to do more creative thinking and more analytical thinking. We have some real strengths that it would be most regrettable if we let slide.
This idea I really thought was fascinating, the way you laid it out in that lecture, that you're kind of alluding to this communitarian tradition, as you put it, the gray area between absolutism, nothing being necessarily black and white in this day and age. It seems like so often we try to make it that, the way you set up the Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural statement. It seems like these lofty thoughts appear to be losing resonance in today's politics, and I don't quite understand it.
Well, honestly, the idea of humility in politics and the dangers of overweening power in politics, the origins of those insights are theological.
That's right.
There are non-theological ways of expressing this and understanding it, of course, but this isn't just a gray area. This is a clear warning sign from human history and from what we know about human nature. You know, when you read James Madison on the Constitution, people think of him as a son of the Enlightenment. Well, he sounds like a pretty good Calvinist, actually, in talking about the dangers of any person or any institution having unchecked power. And modern thinkers like Reinhold Niebuhr have brought those thoughts forward and helped us understand that even when we're most confident of ourselves and the righteousness of our cause, that's when we need to be perhaps most aware of the infiltration of pride and a kind of self-centered view, a kind of narrow view of the world, to compromise even our best efforts at achieving community and justice. So that's at its root an insight into human nature. And human nature is explored thoroughly in our literary and religious traditions. Right. And students at whatever level are much better equipped to be good citizens and good people.
That's right.
If they think about these things.
Chairing the Commission in Humanities and Social Sciences, what today in that world, what excites you most about that position?
This commission was requested by members of Congress, including David Price, and then it was commissioned by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and I'm greatly honored to be asked to co-chair it. Very interesting thing. It has plenty of academics on it. The presidents of many universities are on it. But it also has, well, gosh, Yo-Yo Ma is on it. Former Supreme Court Justice David Souter is on it. George Lucas, the filmmaker, is on it. All kinds of people. And people in business, the head of Boeing, is on this commission. And the interest of it is we realize you're not going to further the cause of the humanities by asking only people who already know and love it to make the case. It's been helpful here to reach out to a wider group of people who see the value and know how to express that value in many other contexts. Very striking to me is when business people speak on this committee, how much they speak as if the core values that they look for in their best employees are ones with a humanistic origin, the ability to communicate, the power of empathy, the ability to sit in a room of people and enter into someone else's point of view, the ability to deal with people across cultural boundaries, either across cultures in our own nation or across cultures around the world. These are essential humanistic skills, and it helps for us to remember when we talk about the humanities, we don't just mean a set of pages in a college course catalog. We're talking about very fundamental human gifts.
Those of us in the Congress who have suggested that this commission be set up hope that they will take it in their own direction. So we're not burdened with a lot of preconceptions about right. what this should look like. And so President Broadhead and this very diverse group of scholars and performers and interpreters, we think they can make a real contribution here at a critical time when decisions are being made at all levels about American education and cultural life. So we look forward very much to the results of their work.
In this country, scientific research is supported by the government. It can't be accomplished without big investments. Those investments have been made by the federal government, by universities, and then by the private sector over the space of many years. In the arts and the humanities, the major support doesn't come from the federal government. It's a very different thing. And so actually, when we make our case should not be a case trying to persuade congressmen and senators. The best support of the humanities is the daily support that comes out of communities that feel enriched by arts and humanities and that therefore see the need to support them. So you want it to be something that has a federal dimension, a state dimension, a local dimension, something that local community volunteer groups understand they can support. It doesn't take a ton of money to support the humanities.
President Broadhead and Representative Price, I really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedules to talk with me this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Scholar, statesman, North Carolina Congressional Representative David Price. In October of 2011, he was awarded the North Carolina Humanities Council's most prestigious honor, the John Tyler Caldwell Award. He was joined in the Durham studio by Duke University President Richard Broadhead. The North Carolina Humanities Council has been advocating for lifelong learning and thoughtful dialogue about all facets of human life for nearly 40 years, helping us explore and celebrate the many voices, stories, cultures, and heritage of North Carolina. The statewide nonprofit is based in Greensboro, and it's an affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. You'll find more about the goings-on at the North Carolina Humanities Council at wfdd.org/triadarts. Coming up after this short intermission, our good friend, Steinway artist Mr. Peter Karoff, will tickle the ivories for us and pay homage to Frederick the Great. That'd be Frederick Chopin. Peter's got the inside track on what makes Chopin's music so gripping, even 200 years since his birth. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the keyboard.
A major composer who confined almost everything he wrote to the piano, Frédéric Chopin. You know, if you think of all the other great composers, Beethoven and Bach and Mozart, they wrote in all sorts of styles. They wrote symphonies and vocal music and on and on. And Chopin almost completely wrote for the piano. He wrote a few pieces for piano and singers, piano and cello and so on. But really, the heart and soul of Chopin's music is at the keyboard. He's sometimes called the poet of the piano because his music seems to speak to us in a way that takes music to a more profound and almost a literary level. It makes you want to say, what's it about? You know, what's he trying to say? Well, Chopin's music is not just dreamy. There are plenty of pieces like that in this kind of gentle and dreamy style, but quite a few of them where he just tears up the keyboard. He was, after all, a real virtuoso. You know that word, a virtuoso, someone who was just an incredible performer. There were piano virtuosos traveling all through the world, the kind of rock stars of their day, really. People would swoon at their concerts and just be astonished not only at the beauty of their music, but at the facility at their instrument, whether it was the piano or the violin or even singers. I think really the core to understanding Chopin's music, however, might seem ironic, is not really the piano at all, but it's rather the human voice. You know, Chopin told his students, if you really want to know how to play the piano well, listen to great singers. And so much of Chopin's music is inspired by the kinds of arias that he was hearing in Italian bel canto operas in the first half of the 19th century. Well, there, your right hand is the soprano. Your left hand is a simple orchestral accompaniment. And the singer can then float above it. Well, the tradition of these Italian opera singers in the 1820s and 30s and 40s was to not simply sing their melodies straight, but rather to ornament and to embellish and to add. And Chopin does that sort of thing all the time. So the simple melody becomes embellished with these extra moving lines. Sometimes it's embellished like an opera singer by adding florid melodic additions. So the simple becomes, we think of that style as Chopin-esque, but actually Chopin himself would have thought of that as operatic. Chopin's also famous for writing a set of pieces that basically show what he can do at the piano and what future generations of pianists can strive to achieve. These pieces are called etudes. An etude in French is simply a practice piece, a study piece. Just something to strengthen the fingers. But in Chopin's hands, these etudes become something transcendent. Now, let's say you have an issue and you want to write a piece with a fast right hand and nothing much going on in the left hand. Well, there's an etude for that. If you want a fast left hand, you want to work on your left hand agility, there's an etude for that. The The great thing about Chopin etudes is that they're not just piano music, they're just great music. And that's the thing about Chopin in general. His music moves the soul. It never feels confined to the realm of simply being, quote-unquote, just piano music. It's music that speaks to the ages. Frédéric Chopin.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Mr. Peter Karoff at the keyboard. That's Understanding Classical Music on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And from Championing Chopin, we'll do a little dance with Winston-Salem Festival Ballet. They've got something in store specifically designed to delight young people, and come to think about it, just about anyone else who happens to love classic fairy tales set to the most beloved pieces of Western classical music by an award-winning choreographer and performed by some of our region's most talented dancers. It's the return of the Winston-Salem Festival Ballet's Fairy Tale series, this year featuring Jack and the Beanstalk, The Three Little Pigs, and Hansel and Gretel. Performances will be this Saturday, January 5th, at 11 in the morning and 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Haynes Brands Theater. Winston-Salem Festival Ballet founder and artistic director Gary Taylor spoke with me recently about the production. I began by asking him what comes first, the music or the choreography?
It's usually the music, and the music inspires me to decide which story I'm going to do. This time I truly searched for music that would depict more of the storyline, and Hansel and Gretel had a more melodic, fun quality, because that was a tough story to try to tell, because unfortunately the stepmother in the story that is such a wicked character, you know, for me it was a challenge to not make her so evil that she is. I wanted it to be more lighthearted, and so when I started listening to it, Offenbach, which is where it started jumping into. It started loving the tunes and just started seeing all these wonderful dance moments and how Hansel and Gretel were light and they really enjoyed life. They couldn't help that, you know, their parents were having a rough time, but, you know,
they're kids.
And so I really loved how that came about. And then, of course, with the story about the breadcrumbs and the birds, just opened up a whole nother thing.
As always, with Winston-Salem Festival Ballet, some chance for interaction with the audience. And this being a young person's production, even before they get to the show, I understand, you can go online and learn a peppy little tune from The Three Pigs.
Yes, we decided this year in the lobby, we always do face painting, and we show the kids maybe a little short little dance segment so they can recognize thematic steps or something like that with the dance. And so we decided this year to do a short instructional film on The Three Little Pigs dance. And also to let the children understand, I created a dance phrase of not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. And we wanted them to at least learn it so when they were watching the ballet, they could actually see the dance phrase and see the moves and learn it and be able to do it themselves, because it's quite humorous.
Going down the line of these stories, which one has come to life for you most, and what aspect of the story really grabs you?
I love all three of them extremely well. They all touch you in such a different way, and they tell the story in such a wonderful way that it just leaves a smile on your face. When I'm working with the ballets, it's wonderful just to be doing what you love to do and getting to enjoy it. So, I mean, Hansel and Gretel, it has its wonderful part about it that has its humor and its light. And Jack and the Beanstalk, it has things that happen on stage that children are going to get actually see a giant on stage. A giant, you know. And they're going to get to see a cow dance, which is not two people, you know, like the typical thing you might see. It's not, you know, so it's very unique and a lot of humor. And you really get to feel Jack's excitement when he gets these beans that he's so thrilled to tell his mother that he got for that cow, the magic beans, and her disappointment. So we really feel that through the dance and through the dancer's way of portraying that.
Winston-Salem Festival Ballet founder and artistic director Gary Taylor. His ballet, A Fairy Tale Series, will be Saturday, January 5th at 11 o'clock and 2 in the Haynes Brands Theater in downtown Winston-Salem. Come see Gary's award-winning choreography performed by some of the area's most talented dancers. Winston-Salem Festival Ballet is a funded partner of the Arts Council of Winston-Salem Forsyth County, and you'll find more information about both organizations on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Hansel and Gretel, Jack and the Beanstalk, and Three Little Pigs like you've never seen or heard them before with the Winston-Salem Festival Ballet. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and it's shaping up to be quite the artistic potpourri today. Film, humanities, Chopin, ballet, and we've got, let's see, contemporary music on the way. But first, break out your opera glasses. We're off to the Met. That's right. You know, enjoying the Metropolitan Opera from the comfort of the Triad is today's reality, thanks to the Piedmont Opera, Hanesbrands Theater, and the incredible Met Live HD performance series. For just $18, you can see and hear the Met live on the big screen in cinematic high-def splendor. The cost is $15 for students, and this year, with the greatest operas ever by Verdi, Mozart, Wagner, and more, you just don't want to miss it. On Saturday, January 12th at noon, it's The Trojans by Hector Berlioz, and on the 19th at 12:55, it'll be Donizetti's Maria Stuarda. Verdi's Rigoletto follows on Saturday, September 16th, and in the spring, it's Riccardo Zandonai's Francesca da Rimini. You'll find links to the Met's complete HD broadcast calendar at wfdd.org/triadarts. Piedmont Opera Artistic Director Jamie Albritton stopped by for a preview.
It's a huge, spectacular piece. For the longest time, Les Troyens was sort of carved into two operas, and you never saw it complete. And the Met's one of the few houses, certainly in our country, that could afford and have the musical resources to be able to bring that behemoth to the stage. So this is really one of those not-miss moments, because you certainly never see it here before, and you won't get to see it again for a long time, I think. I will say, too, for those that have seen the HD broadcast, this brings together another pair of people that we saw before in the HD broadcast. With Fanciulla del West a few years ago, we had Deborah Voigt and Marcello Giordani together, and it's the same pair together for this Les Troyens. And with a baritone who I really, really like and actually worked with once, Dwayne Croft. He's a great guy and a beautiful lyric singer, so it's a really strong cast.
Following the Berlioz in January, on the 19th, is an opera that you're more than familiar with,
yes.
Maria Stuarda. And this, was that a Fletcher production?
It was.
All right. Not too long ago, but a Met premiere of
yes.
the work.
Yeah, the Met sort of decided around the same time that we produced Maria Stuarda, having obviously nothing to do with it, the Met announced that they were going to do the famous Donizetti trilogy. So we had Anna Bolena last season, and we have Maria Stuarda this season, and then next season we'll have Roberto Devereux, so that we complete that English Queen trilogy. I love Anna Bolena. It's a great opera. But Maria Stuarda, it's just not as cool a piece, I think, as Anna Bolena is. And it's interesting, Maria Stuarda, they've taken a more romantic approach to it, rather than just with Anna Bolena, they said, we were trying to, you know, reproduce Elizabethan England down to the stitch on the hem. And they said, with this one, they've taken a little bit looser tone with it and tried to be a little bit more romantic. And I was glad to hear that, because I think it's exactly right. Maria Stuarda, for those of you who are listening who don't know, has that famous moment in it at the end of the first act where the two queens actually have this knockdown, drag-out fight, Elizabeth and Maria. It never happened. Schiller made it up. It's his play that it's based on. But wow, what a sizzling moment of opera that is. You'll never forget when she calls out to her, Vil Bastarda! Parli tu di disonore!
This is Verdi's year, and Rigoletto yes. on the program, and
but this just ain't your mother's Rigoletto here coming up at the Met, right?
Is this going to be a modern version of Rigoletto? What are we?
Vegas, 1960. You know, I have to say it's an interesting choice. I am not the greatest fan of updating opera. I think when you can make it work with the plot, it's fascinating to make it more tangible to a modern-day audience. And 60s Vegas is obviously closer to an American audience than anything else you would imagine with Rigoletto. But it was interesting, the director, it's Michael Meyer is his name. He's a Broadway director. His last Broadway show was Spring Awakening, which won a Tony. He also directed Thoroughly Modern Millie on Broadway. He talked about trying to find a place, thinking about the tenor and his sort of amoral lifestyle. And he was saying, how can I find a place where that lifestyle would resonate with an American audience? And he immediately thought of Vegas in the 60s and thinking of the Duke of Mantua as, you know, maybe one of the Rat Pack, and thinking of this Rigoletto with his daughter Gilda trying to protect her from the amoral life that is there in Las Vegas. And I thought to myself, you know, as interesting, to be polite, as Vegas in the 60s for Rigoletto sounds, I get that. I see what he's going for. He's trying to find a place where amorality lives and where someone could empathize with a man trying to shield his daughter from that lifestyle.
Piedmont Opera Artistic Director Jamie Albritton. Coming up at Piedmont Opera March 15th through the 19th, it's time for a haircut with, you guessed it, Rossini's The Barber of Seville. You'll find links to ticket information and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. In the meantime, you can get your opera fix courtesy of Piedmont Opera, HanesBrands Theater, and the Met Live HD Performance Series. For just $18, you can see and hear the world's most accomplished opera singers joined by arguably today's finest orchestra, all on the big screen in high def. Best of all, it's just a stone's throw away. The cost is $15 for students. On Saturday, January 12th at noon, it's The Trojans by Hector Berlioz. And on the 19th at 12:55, it'll be Donizetti's Maria Stuarda. Verdi's Rigoletto follows on Saturday, February 16th. And in the spring, it's Riccardo Zandonai's Francesca da Rimini. You'll find links to the Met's complete HD broadcast calendar at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and now for a cool dip into 21st century waters. Forecast Music is an adventurous new music group founded in Brooklyn, New York, back in 2001. Their mission is to present innovative American music in both traditional concert halls as well as venues that might just surprise you, like the Garage, Community Arts Cafe, the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art. That's right, Forecast now calls Winston-Salem home. Its roster includes some of the world's finest composers and performers living right here in North Carolina. Forecast Music co-founder, pianist, and composer Eric Schwartz dropped by to talk about it. Take us back from Brooklyn to Winston-Salem with love. How about a Forecast 101 for
sure.
Those who don't know?
Well, Forecast was formed in beautiful Brooklyn, New York back in 2000/2001. A bunch of us young, hip, New York City composer types. I believe I was still in graduate school at the time. We were looking for some sort of alternate venue to get our work performed. I mean, we wanted something that wasn't, you know, Carnegie Hall, that wasn't conventional orchestras, that was just a little bit more near and dear to our hearts since we'd grown up, you know, rock concerts and smoky bars and all that stuff.
What were composers doing before Forecast to do just that, get your music performed?
It's a really good question. I mean, the main venue in the late 20th century for getting one's work performed, and this is kind of depressing, was academia. I mean, you know, most of the composers that were working, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s, were really centered around the university system. And that is a very warm embrace from the whole institutional thing. But at the same time, it led to a lot of not terribly user-friendly music because it was composers performing music for composers. And so I think throughout the 70s and into the 80s particularly, composers were really trying to break out of that. And so we didn't invent this model. I think it was really, you know, groups like Bang on a Can were amongst the forerunners of what we do at Forecast. But the basic idea was to find these alternate venues to get just a bunch of friends that were, you know, between gigs to play our work. And, you know, we just rent out the cheapest space space possible, get a whole bunch of beer and wine, and you know, people would come, listen to an hour's worth of contemporary music, and then hang out and talk to the composers, talk to the performers, and that was kind of the atmosphere that we wanted.
Yeah.
And you know, 10 odd years hence, it's still kind of the atmosphere that I want. I mean, I love, you know, highfalutin symphony orchestra concerts as much as the next guy. But, you know, contemporary music doesn't comfortably fit into this 19th century concert mold. And it feels to me slightly wrong, slightly. It's just not the concert experience I expect when I'm hearing this outrageously cool rock-influenced, jazz-influenced, electronic-influenced music. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Forecast has really always been about, from its inception in Brooklyn, and then to skip a bunch of years but conclude the story, in 2009, I came to the beautiful Winston-Salem area to take up my position at UNCSA and brought the group, the sort of the group concept, the name, and the model down with me, and reconstituted it with our amazing local musicians, particularly those amazing local musicians who are focused on contemporary music. And there's a big number of those people, and I think they were just hungry for some sort of outlet. And this sort of non-conventional 21st century chamber music outlet just fits like a glove.
That's one of the aspects of Forecast that's so appealing. You're harnessing the power that's already here in terms of performance and compositionally as well, and we can talk about both. But first, one of the themes has been cultivating specific ideas or concepts, thematic approaches to concerts.
Well, one of the things, I mean, this is obviously something that developed only last year in the move to North Carolina, but one of the things that I'm really focused on now that I think is a very effective model and just very appropriate is focusing on local. You know, it's a kind of a spin-off of farmers markets and local produce and all that jazz. And the idea is, as you said, we have this amazing wealth of local talent. I mean, we happen to be in an artistically inclined, you know, small but solidly sized city that has a whole bunch of universities in and around it. And so all of this just internationally reputed talent is there to be harnessed. So instead of necessarily focusing on, you know, bringing the finest music from New York City and European capitals, which has all kinds of virtue and is a swell thing to do, you know, we have this Triad Composers Concerts, which we started last year. And to me, it's a keeper. I mean, it's just such a, you know, to have our local musicians playing our local composers, and there's so much great music. So that, to me, is a real, it kind of expresses everything that Forecast is about.
Forecast Music co-founder, award-winning composer, pianist, and University of North Carolina School of the Arts music director for the School of Dance, Eric Schwartz. For an hour of exciting new music at local venues composed and performed by remarkable composers and musicians who all call the Triad home, you need look no further than Forecast Music. You'll find links to more at wfdd.org/triadarts. Thank you.
Well, that's all for today's show. Our senior producer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and more information about all of today's artists on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. Please send me your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.